Welcome all to this week's Q&A session. If we have any guests with us tonight, welcome. We always welcome guests at meetings of the Ottawa PC User Group, and that includes our Q&A sessions. If you want to become a member, we'd be happy to have you join. Don't feel obliged to do so. I am now going to mute everybody. And you do have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a question or comment, please remute yourself after talking to keep background noise at a minimum. Later on this evening, the audio track, the contents of the chat window, and a PDF of the main deck will go up on our website. So if you want to check back there, you can get a replay of tonight's session. And so with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris. We have a lot of information tonight, so we'll get right to it. And we're going to start with a share from Chris.
Yeah, this was an interesting one I came across about a data breach. And so I've talked before about the site I've been pawned, or pwned, .com. And it's a place you can go to, and you can check your email address to see whether it has shown up in any of the public data breaches that have happened over the years. And you can also submit your email address to be notified in the future if something shows up. Well, I talked about that in that article. It's also in the chat window if you wanted to pick up the URL for that where I talked about it. Next. So the other day I received an email saying that my email address had showed up in a data breach. And if you get one of these, my first advice is don't panic, but definitely look into it because it could be something serious that you need to react to. Next. So if I look at the email, you know, and I analyze this, I see the email that was found, chris.taylor@opcug.ca. Yep, that's me. Next. And then I see where the breach was, and it's question pro. I have no idea who Question Pro is. Then I have what it was actually compromised. And so it lists the what was reported. So browser user agent details, email address, the IP address, and survey results. So that's what they are reporting. Now, it might not have actually been a breach because go down into the description, and it actually says that Question Pro wouldn't confirm whether a breach had actually occurred, but they confirmed that they were a target of an extortion attempt. So somebody was either actually in they had all of this data, or they just pretending to be and trying to get some money out of this company. So I checked in my KeePass password keeper, and there was no entry for that particular site, just in case I had years ago set up something. So I Googled Question Pro, and sure enough, it came up with a site, and it's a survey site. So I think this is typically used by other companies who want to have a survey done. They will farm it out to Question Pro to actually handle the survey, and they'll get the results back from that. So I clicked at the login screen, and then I clicked on the forgot password, because if I ever did have one, it wasn't in my password keeper. So I put in my email address and hit the reset password. And sure enough, I never received an email, you know, which you typically will get afterwards saying, click here to finalize the reset of your account. So I'm presuming at that point that I really did never have an account at the Question Pro site. Presumably this site, I was, you know, led to that site, I guess, by some other company that was conducting a survey. And so it was handled by this. So that's how my email address ended up in their databases. Next. So my final analysis on it was that, well, it may not have been a data breach. You know, they only admitted to extortion attempt. So maybe the data actually didn't get out there. Data was probably not sensitive. So browser user agent details, who cares? Email address, well, my email address is public. My IP address, well, you know, who cares? And then, whoops, survey results. Well, I don't know. I don't know what survey I responded to, you know, that used that particular site of Question Pro. So if this data did get out, I have absolutely no clue whether it's really sensitive information or something like that that I don't want out. Now, I have no account on the site. So I could send a request to the site to delete any data they have about me, because why should they hang on to it if there is a data breach in the future? I certainly don't want my data to be part of that dump that goes out to some attacker. I sort of thought, is this really worth my time to do this? And I'd rather spend my time creating these slides for Q&A. So next. But then again, they did have an online chat function. So I jumped into that and, you know, I looked at it and I said I received a message from Have I Been Pwned about a possible data breach. And I just want to make, I checked, I don't have an account on your site. I just want to make sure that any data that you might be holding on me is actually deleted. And that's what I was actually requesting. So they responded and said that they were already aware of this, and that all of the people will be contacted within hours. So, okay, that's fine, but that's not what I was looking for. So I went back again and I said, well, look at really what I have there is I don't have an account. All I want is that you delete any data you have about Chris.Taylor at opcug.ca. And so then they responded back to that. And they said, sure, we'll let the team know about this. So, you know, the long and short, you know, next, will they delete my data? I have absolutely no clue. There's nothing else I really can do, that will help the situation along on that. So I think I've done as much as I can. And so I think that that was the end of it. Well, maybe not. I don't know. A couple of hours later, I got an email thanking me for signing up with Question Pro. And so I presume when I did the password reset attempt, that somehow triggered one of their salespeople, to contact me and try to sell me their services and so forth. So I responded next and I just told them exactly what it was about. And then they responded back to that saying, thank you very much. And, next. They responded back saying thanks, and they'll shoot it off to the appropriate internal contact. I have not heard anything from the site since then. I've done everything I can. There is a possibility that there's some sensitive survey information that I responded to that has gone out. Probably not. Usually when I do surveys, I'll often answer, you know, what brand of coffee I drink, or, do I own my home? I might answer things like that. I'm not likely to admit to my, things like my mental stability and issues such as that I might not like to actually have out there. So I thought this was just an interesting thing that I could share with people about how to analyze if you do sign up for notification from Have I Been Pwned, that, you know, you can analyze it a little bit and respond accordingly.
And Natalie's pointing out that sometimes this is an aggregate, it's part of an aggregate breach, and it's hard to tell where the breach actually was.
Yeah, it's a kind of possible.
She found some companies that were supposed to be breached, but they've since ceased to exist. So it's then too late to delete the account or change the password. So The suggestion is get rid of the accounts as soon as you don't use them.
Yeah, in this case, it was kind of hard because I didn't really even know that, you know, the data was being kept by this third party that I never signed into. So it was an interesting case in point. But, yeah, that I think is a really good suggestion, that if you're going to no longer use a particular site and you have created an account on that site, not a bad idea to delete your account from that particular site and all data that they have on you, if that's possible as well.
And Stuart's asking, if anybody remembers when the phone company published a big book with all our names, addresses, and phone numbers. We liked it.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So I have a quick share here. It's kind of a silly thing, but it's basically because it's about Troy Hunt, who is actually the creator of Have I Been Pwned? And he's basically set up a website that attracts spammers, and then he gets them to sign up for an account and basically ask them for a password. And so, first of all, it accepts any password, and then it comes back and says, oh, no, it must contain at least one uppercase letter. And then it comes back and says, well, it also has to end with dog. And then it comes back and says it has to start with cat. And it goes on and on and on until the spammer gets tired and quits. So don't sign up for one of Troy Hunt's websites. But, okay, next share is Chris has got something on Google Maps.
Yeah, it's actually Google Maps Timeline is the feature that I'm going to talk about. And I did turn on Google Maps tracking, the location tracking a while ago for a specific purpose and that. And I thought I'd talk a little bit about, you know, what the ramifications are and things like that. So you can set up your Android phone so that it will record the location, and it'll do it either by GPS or by cellular signal and estimating your location and so forth. And it'll keep an ongoing record of this, and you can go to their site and look to see where you've been and so forth. So, you know, as you have this turned on, it'll just be recording that detail. So I find that it can be useful to you, but there are some privacy implications that you may want to think about. So it is protected as part of your Google account. So that the only way to access this Google Maps timeline is to be logged into a browser using your Google account. And so it should be pretty well protected. I do trust that Google knows how to do security fairly well, as long as there are no breaches at Google, which, you know, you don't hear about this on an ongoing basis, certainly, or your account is compromised. So as long as you have a good, strong password on your account, and it's unlikely that somebody's going to be able to hack into it and gain access to the information. Next. So if you wanted to manage your location history, turning this on or turning it off and so forth, the URL is there, and I pasted that into the chat window as well. Next.
So it says Pixel phone. It works for any phone?
Yeah, any Android phone should be able to work with it, yeah. So I'm not recommending that you either enable or disable this feature. It's something that I find has some uses. But certainly if you don't have use for the what is provided on this, I certainly do recommend at that point that you do disable it if you have no use for it. So it can give what I think are a little bit surprising details about your life. And it is good to understand what is really going on with this. The nice thing is Google is very good about being upfront about what they're collecting, how they're using it, things like, well, not totally on how they're using it, maybe, but what is being collected and what you can do about whether it's collected or not. So you'll get a monthly email from Google, and it'll say, oh, there's an update here, and there's links to manage your settings and things like right there, so you can click on that, you can turn it off, you decide, well, I don't remember ever turning that on, and you can go in, you can manage those particular settings. Next. So I find it really kind of useful. So this was just recently I was on a trip to the Maritimes, and every red dot you see on the map there are locations where I was or my phone was throughout this. So I can use it as sort of like a diary of my trip. And I find in particular really helps when captioning photos, because I can go in and I can click on any of those dots and I can get date and time and things like that. And then I can match that up to the EXIF information on my photographs, and I can say, oh yeah, that's where I was at that particular time. And even if there's not a perfect match, I can say, oh yeah, this photo was taken 20 minutes later. Well, that was on the road between this spot and this spot. And I can sort of nail down things and I can caption them and give some more fulsome information about my particular trip through my photographs, which I find kind of neat. Next. So you can get extra details by clicking on one of those red dots, and here it'll give things like your walking or driving, your distance and the time. So here I was just walking in the neighborhood, and so you can see I was running, you know, I walked a little over 6 kilometers in just over an hour, and it shows me exactly where I actually walked on that particular day. So kind of interesting information if you're a fitness buff or something like that. Now, some of the details, and this is where it gets into a little bit of that, it's a little bit personal maybe. You know, if I look at the top left, I was at the morning at the Holland Cross Dental Center. Okay, well, now if my data gets compromised, you know, everybody can know where my dentist is. Is that good or bad? I don't know. It also isn't 100% accurate. The one that's in more of the center, that's Dr. Valiant. Now, that's interesting because it's in a clinic where Dr. Valley is one of the doctors there. I happen to see a different doctor in the same clinic, but, you know, going to a doctor's office. Over on the right-hand side, off watching a movie at Scotiabank Theatres on one day. And then, well, a little bit more personal, I think, Life Labs Medical Laboratory Services. So, you know, everybody goes and gets, you know, lab tests done, blood tests and things like that. So it's not really a big deal, but, you know, it's a little bit, I wonder if that's okay to be disclosing this sort of information. And then, again, the inaccuracy of it, the bottom left, you know, it's the Service Ottawa site at Ben Franklin Place. Well, I wasn't at the Service Ottawa site. I was actually at the Jason Mraz concert that was in the same building. And now, so, you know, it, but it does give that location information. And so it can be useful if you want to keep track of this sort of stuff. If you're concerned about it as being sensitive data, you might not want to use this particular feature. Next. So my recommendation, and, you know, to say again, I'm not recommending you enable or disable it. It's up to you. So it can definitely provide some useful information, but you might find it a little bit on the creepy side, the level of details that are there. Again, it's protected as part of your Gmail account or your Google account, but, you know, you may decide that you just don't want that information there at all. I'm not particularly worried that Google is going to actually disclose the information to anybody else, but I think, and this is just a hypothesis on my part, that they might use that data to charge some advertisers more. So, for example, if they see that I frequent M&M Food Market, if M&M goes to them, you know, and says, well, we want to target ads, and they might charge more to target ads to people that frequent their neighborhood, okay? M&M is not going to get any benefit to an ad being shown to somebody that is in, you know, Toronto, well, there are M&Ms in Toronto, but, you know, some remote location where there is no M&M store. So they might be willing to pay more money if they know that those ads are going to people that are in the neighborhood or something like that. So that might be the case. I don't know, but I don't particularly care either. I don't think that Google is giving, you know, information saying Chris.Taylor at opcug.ca, oh, he was outside your store on such and such a day. No, they're just going to aggregate that information and say, we're going to target information in the following manner, and they can charge more for it. I suspect that that's what the case is. So that's all I had on that.
Natalie's asking if the Google timeline is off by default.
I don't think it is, but if you look in the chat window, you can definitely go to the URL that I pasted in there, and you can see whether it's turned on or off, but I'm pretty sure.
I think it's by default because I have it, and I never made any effort.
Okay.
I'm not good at those things, so if it's showing on mine, it was because it was a default.
Okay, interesting. Do you get the monthly email from?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if it's turned on, you should be getting that monthly email. And so if you are getting that and you don't want it, definitely click the manage settings and you can turn it off. If you're not getting it, it's probably not turned on for you, but you can always go to that URL and check it out to see that it is turned off.
Maybe this is just for Pixel people, because I don't get an email from them every month on my Android phone.
Oh, really? And is it turned on your phone?
I have no idea.
Okay, well, that would be the thing. Is it maybe it's just on Pixels that it's on by default? I don't know.
I assume it's off by default on mine.
Yeah. I would assume, knowing Google, I would assume that that would actually be something that would be off by default. They don't tend to really push those sort of services on people. I find that they're one of the more responsible of the companies out there. A lot of people argue with me on that, I'm sure. But I think that they are actually pretty responsible in the way that they handle people's data and things like that. So I would be interested to know if anybody
I got finds it on my Samsung. It wasn't just my Pixel. I had it on my Samsung.
Okay. I'd be interested to know if anybody has it finds that it's turned on and they never turned it on, and especially if it's turned on and they're not getting the monthly email. I'd be interested to know that.
Darlene has a question here which might be a possibility. I turn the location system, my GPS, I turn it off on my phone. Now she's asking, if you turned off location on an Android phone, is Google still gathering information similar to what they have for you, Chris?
I don't think they can if you've turned off location services on the phone.
So maybe that's why I'm not getting anything.
Yeah.
Alison says she started getting monthly emails in 2020, but never turned it on. And in the first few days of COVID, she found it funny as she was only 3 kilometers radius of her house, which was her daily walk. Lawrence says it happened on his Samsung. He doesn't know whether it turned it on or off, but he finds it useful. And Claudette says she gets monthly emails on a Samsung, but has location turned on.
Yeah.
And Natalie says, the link says services when you're signed into your Google account. You've turned on location history, and the device has location reporting turned on.
Yeah. And there are ways on the Google site, too, that if you go to it, you can actually delete prior history information that, you know, may have been collected there, and you don't want it. You know, you can turn it off, and you can delete any data that has been stored on Google servers up until then.
If I could jump in for a second.
Sure.
Not about the email reporting and what have you, but as to the accuracy of or sensitivity of the location services. When I've used the GasBuddy app, for example, when reporting prices at a pump, say I've plugged in the regular mid-grade and premium prices at a pump, and then, oh, right, there's no diesel here, and I've rolled the car forward to another pump, the app has popped up and reprimanded me for driving while using my phone. Rolling forward 6 feet.
That's interesting.
Oh, you're a bad person, Stuart.
I'm a terrible person. I know that. But the sensitivity is incredible. Yeah. The accuracy, as Chris pointed out, about saying you went to Dr. So-and-so when you were at a massage therapist next door is just, you know, what Google knows about the area.
Yeah.
But the sensitivity as to where your phone is moving is incredible.
Yeah. I thought knowing Google and knowing how far reaching it can be and its knowledge about things, I was kind of surprised about the saying I was at the service center at Ben Franklin Place because I was there in the evening at the Jason Mraz concert. So being in the evening, I would have thought that Google might be smart enough to know that, well, the service center is probably not open being in the evening, but this theater that is in the same building is more likely to be open in the evening as they would tag it instead of the service center. So I just thought that was a curiosity in the inaccuracy of the information. Who knows? Maybe that's something that they're working on, that in the future they'll be able to decipher more information like that or infer more things accurately like that.
I'll bet they're working on that. Then they can sell you theater tickets.
Yeah, that's true.
It's garbage in, garbage out. They only know what's open when people tell them what's open.
Yeah. But a lot of places, like, I mean, if you go to Google Maps and you go to a location, they usually, like stores, they'll tell you, oh, yeah, it's open now. And, you know, it's open from, you know, 10 till 6, and it'll give you every day of the week and, you know, everything like that.
Someone has told them.
Yeah.
Because I have done reporting on Google Maps myself, and they ask me questions. Is this place open at that time or this time?
Oh, cool.
You know, if you go into, say, Google Maps and notifications, and they'll look, or sorry, updates, and then in notifications on your phone, they'll have a whole series of questions about places you've been or been near, and you can answer questions as to what the business is, if it's open, what they sell, what they don't sell.
Cool.
They deep dive right into whatever you're willing to dish out.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Stuart, they can also get some of that stuff automatically because all they have to do is scrape the website and find the hours of business.
Yeah.
But again, that's only based on what people
tell. Well, if they scrape the website, they can do that automatically themselves, but Anyhow, I think we should move on. We've spent a fair amount of time on it. I just thought it'd be interesting. People should check it out, see whether it's turned on, see whether you want it to be turned on or not.
Okay, thanks, Chris. You've got another share coming up, which is an article which I posted on the members forum, but you've expanded on it by the look of it.
Yeah, I thought this was kind of cool, actually. Alan posted this to the member forum about the first issue of PC Magazine back in 1982. And so they have a complete scanned copy. Well, complete. Some of the columns are chopped off a little bit and things like that, but it is the whole issue. And I found it really fascinating to look at the article, and in particular the ads. You know, absolutely astronomical prices for some software, but especially the hardware end of things. And there were articles and things like discussing differences between operating systems. Back at the start, when the PC came out, you know, DOS was only one of the choices that you had out there. There was CPM 86 and there was P System that were also available, and DOS eventually really won out. But at the time, it wasn't clear that was going to be the winner. It was an interview with Bill Gates. So if you want to see early days of Microsoft's thinking on some things, it was a pretty interesting one. And there was some software reviews in there. And boy, if you think the software is quirky now and has oddities to it and doesn't work logically and things like that, you really have to go look at that issue and read the review of Easy Writer. Next.
You trying to tell me that Easy Writer wasn't all that easy?
Well, next slide, I'll have some information on it. So on the hardware side, on advertisements, this is great. A 6.3 megabyte, not terabyte, not gigabyte, megabyte, 6.3 megabyte for $2,900 US. Amazing. Next. Or expanding memory to add 192 kilobytes, not gigabytes, not megabytes. Kilobytes for $1,100 US. That would bring the base 64 kilobyte IBM PC up to a whopping 256 kilobytes. Amazing. And next. Now, this was the Easy Writer one. And this I found actually really quite fascinating. You know, you can isolate a block. So this is how to move a block of text. You can isolate a block of text in the middle of a paragraph simply by entering insert mode and placing block markers where you want them. And you can do a maximum 3,500 characters in a block move. And then next, this was the real killer. One final tip. After Control C and before moving your copy block, delete the trailing block marker and paragraph end by hitting the delete key twice, steps 16 and 17 in the 21-step routine above. Then delete the leading marker by doing the same thing, moves 20 and 21. Once the copy has been placed in the new location, this will save you undue cursor movement. I thought that was absolutely incredible. So I highly recommend take a look at at the magazine. It is a fun read, really fascinating information in there. Thanks very much to Alan for posting that to the member forum.
Okay, so here's the issue on the website, Chris.
Yeah, okay. So the John Miner, who's on the call tonight, so he can take questions or, you know, you can unmute yourself or pose any questions into the chat if you want. So the Orleans Photo Club, which is managed by John, John is looking for some help with it. So a couple of things specifically that he's looking for. So he's setting up a staging site so that they can test changes, before they go on the production, to make sure that bad things don't happen. Right now, basically any changes that are done on the live site. And then if something bad happens, it's a matter of rolling back the changes, which can sometimes be tricky. So, helping to set up a staging site would be one of the things he's looking for. Assisting in doing a security audit of the website. They currently do have the WordFence plugin that they're using for that, but John is not a security guru, and he's somewhat concerned that maybe, you know, not everything that should be done on a WordPress site is being done currently. He'd also like to get, you know, information on what people have done in terms of training to learn WordPress in order to maintain it properly. and also in learning how to do PHP coding. The site is a lot of very stock stuff, but there was a custom WordPress plugin that was created that goes along with the photo competition. So it's a way of us displaying the photos and calculating who the winner was and things like that. So the person who did that actually lives in Europe now and really doesn't want to have anything to do with it. So there's some concern about whether that is going to be maintainable if we have issues with the actual code. So if there's anybody who knows anything about PHP coding on a WordPress site, or at least knows a training path that, you know, here's a good place to go and learn more, then John is definitely interested in that. So if you can help, or if you know somebody else who might be able to help out, you can email John at miner.ca. And again, he is on the call tonight. So if you have any question or comments, you can ask them tonight or email them later on. And Alan took it upon himself to go add a couple of slides as extra info on here, so I'll let you take it away, Alan.
Yeah, so if anybody does have a good handle on the hosting service is Bluehost. I don't know anything about that, but there's quite a bit of information about Bluehost and what you can do with it on the web, and also PHP. If anybody is a PHP guru, I'm sure you could help John sort through the code. So if you know anything that can be helpful, put it in the chat or open up your microphone later on. We'll post this information on the members forum, so that could give it a slightly wider audience maybe. But in the meantime, the thing that I always recommend that people do, everybody's been bad-mouthing Google for security issues today, but everybody knows that Google is actually really, really useful when you want to find stuff. And the other place to look is YouTube University, because they seem to know how to do everything. And so here I've just searched for WordPress tutorials and PHP tutorials. I've limited the search to videos, so basically these will be YouTube videos. And you can see that I'm starting to get hits, tutorial for beginners, how to make a website with WordPress, full course language tutorial, and then there's, you know, how to go. This is PHP in 5 hours. So, you know, there's all kinds of information available on the web, and some of these things are really good. I've used these things for other tasks, and they've proven to be really, really useful. And the second source that I use a lot for this kind of stuff is the public library. Because if you go and search their website, basically their catalog, you'll find that they've got a whole bunch of basically how-to manuals. So, for example, WordPress, it pulls out quite a whole bunch of different manuals that are available for WordPress. And the nice thing here, of course, is you can, if it's available, these are all available right now, you can reserve it for 21 days, and if nobody else wants it, you can just extend that for another 21 days. So you've got lots of time to go through these things at your leisure. And typically, they're really well documented, some of these things. And if you don't like one, then, you know, choose the next one. and they often have lots of example code in there, which you can play with and find out how to do things. So I highly recommend both of those things if nobody in the club can come up with a better, more targeted assistance on WordPress and PHP.
I noticed that Bridget has posted into the chat that Bridget manages the website for the PC User Group, and she runs WordFence plugin as well as Malcare plugin. Both are firewalls and will scan your site for malware. So, John, I can get you Bridget's email address as well, or she's listed on our website as well. If you have any other questions, Bridget does run, you know, she manages our website, which is a WordPress site as well.
Okay, I would appreciate that.
Yeah, I don't think we have any custom plugins or anything like that. Some, you know, we have some calendar plugins and stuff like that, just stock stuff. So I don't think anybody has got, and Bridget says, I'll try to help. My knowledge is limited. Don't know PHP. So,
yeah. If I could just comment,
sure.
I have attempted to, search for resources on my own. And one of the things that I haven't found is a good resource that talks about PHP custom programming within the WordPress framework, because the WordPress API is pretty vast.
All right.
And trying to, you know, just understand enough that I can get started, I'm finding difficult.
Yeah.
So I can't say that I have spent 2 weeks researching this, and I was hoping that if I could talk to your users, somebody would spoon feed me the exact pathway that I should follow.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm being a little bit too lazy and unrealistic.
Well, no, it certainly doesn't hurt to ask. I don't know if any of our audience is familiar with it at that sort of level, but certainly doesn't hurt to ask. And if I'm sure if anybody does have experience of PHP within the WordPress context, that they might be able to help you out. So,
okay. Yes.
And have you looked for a plugin for your for that, like a plugin in the WordPress world?
Well, this is a really, really specific. I don't think you'd find anything that replicates this very closely.
It's for contests. It's for judging, but is that the only function it has, or
it allows you to upload photos for a contest, and then it will tabulate votes on those images in a number of different categories. Like the voting is just not a single score, it's several scores for each image.
Yeah.
And then, according to a scoring algorithm, it computes the results, and then it presents the results in terms of who the winners are for the two different levels of members that we have in the club.
Okay.
It's pretty complex.
the thing with the plugins, too, is you do want to keep them up to date, and you do mention that in your email that, there are vulnerabilities when you let a plugin go unupdated, when it will become vulnerable to, you do have the firewall. You might want to put up another firewall as well. And I can send you that by email, the malware.
Okay.
It's just another level. It's just another firewall. It doesn't hurt to have two firewalls. It's not like two antiviruses where you don't want them competing. You don't want the two antiviruses fighting. This is different. It's just two firewalls, and they do scan your site for bugs and malware and stuff.
Right.
But, yes, in terms of a plugin for your specific voting requirements, your contest requirements, it's, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, Stu just posted, where's the Udemy man? There's a gentleman who posts quite regularly, Tom, on courses that are available at Udemy, and they have hundreds and hundreds of courses, some free,
right.
some fairly expensive. So you might want to check out the Udemy site. I presume it's udemy.com, but if it's not at that, we'll find it for you. And you might be able to find something there, because they just
right.
have so many different courses, and a lot of them on programming.
Right. Okay. So no, I will check that out.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Stu, for pointing that out.
Okay, so next thing we have is another question, and this is about disk space.
Okay, I'm going to take over screen sharing on this, because I'm going to be wanting to point at things and stuff like that. So let me just, there. And, oh, geez. What are we up to, about 12? More than that. Okay. So the question came in that this is from Bill Hall, and I don't think he's on the call tonight, unfortunately. We did invite him. He's not a member. He is running out of disk space on Drive C. He's running Windows 10. And he says he removed everything he can, with the exception that he had trouble removing some pictures from one of the directories. But I don't think that that alone is a showstopper for him. It's just he's running out of disk space on his C drive. So first thing that came to mind from my perspective is that you can clean up a surprising amount of space just by doing some regular cleanup on your computer without worrying about some more advanced techniques, which I'll talk about a little bit later on. So a Q&A on November 4th and November 11th of last of 2020, we had the ultimate guide to saving disk space. And so you could go check out those PDFs and listen to the recordings as well. And it talked about a number of utilities that could be used that will help you to find those, you know, things that are taking up a whole bunch of disk space that you don't need on your computer. So TreeSize Free allows you to do that. CCleaner does an amazing job of allowing you to clean out things like browser caches, you know, the dumps from when you have crash dumps and things like that, that can be gigabytes worth of files on your computer that are just sitting there not doing any good at all. Duplicate file finder, search my files. Those can all be used to hunt down and eradicate files that you don't need that are using up disk space. I also added in a thing about how to turn off disk indexing, which can actually use up a surprising amount of space on your hard drive just for that index. If you don't use the disk indexing, why not turn it off? You can also use the disk cleanup utility, which is built into Windows, and we talked about it in 2018. And I put the link to that, and these are pasted into the chat window as well. And you can often, with the disk cleanup, find dozens of gigabytes of recoverable space. And this can especially come out with one of the things that it can do a cleanup on that I don't know of any other utility that will actually do this, is cleaning up the Windows update. And so a Windows update, when you get an update come in, it will take previous versions of files and keep them around for a surprising length of time. And so this can go in and clean up those files. I have seen 35 gigabytes get cleaned up out of just the Windows update cleanup. And then I talked a little bit about that as well at another Q&A where we talked about some of the what Windows Update cleanup really is doing and why it takes so long to run on your computer. There's some details about that. So having said that, and that's always good for people to go through and look and see, can they get rid of files on their computer they really don't need? Next thing, fortunately, he sent in a screenshot of disk management on his computer. And I can see that the operating system, Drive C, okay, is there. It's 105 gig partition, and these are mirrored from the top portion and down into this bottom portion. So here's that disk one, and there's the partition for Drive C, 105 gigabytes. And we can see that on this list here, it says there's 5 megabytes free space, not gigabytes, megabytes. So it's 0% free space. I would never want to try to run a Windows computer that had 5 megabytes free space. I think it would just automatically start crashing on you. So the total drive, which we can see here, it's 120 gig drive. So it's probably a solid state drive. And they tend to be a little bit more modest size than typically you find with a hard disk drive with spinning platters. So given that the operating system is using, the Drive C is using 105 out of 119, these other partitions that are on that physical device, you can't really get rid of them and give the space up to that by doing a repartitioning. And I think in a future Q&A, I'll talk about how to do repartitioning. But for now, just think about the fact, well, that's only half a gigabyte. That's only 12 gigabytes, and it's a recovery partition. Probably not something you want to blow away. a 1 gigabyte and it's labeled as being a recovery partition, you probably don't want to get rid of it. You've got 10 megabytes unallocated. It's just not worth looking at this and saying, yes, I'll recover space on there and give it to drive C. So that's not a practical solution for it. So if we look at the other drives that we do have data drive D, and we can see in the lower part here, this is disk zero, is data D, and it's one partition for the entire physical device. And this is basically a 1 terabyte drive. So we've got 931 gigabyte partition, the 1 terabyte drive, and free space is 727 gigabytes. So it's 78% free space. So we got oodles and oodles of space that is available there, considering that you're running out of space on a 100 gigabyte partition, but you've got 727 gigabytes free on another drive. Now, it's not as fast, because I suspect that this is an SSD and this is a hard disk drive with spinning platters, but hey, you got tons and tons of space on there. As well, we also have disk 2, which looks to be a 5 terabyte drive, and it's completely empty. If we look at the list up on the top there, disk 2 partition 1, and we see that I can match it up most easily by looking at, well, it says disk 2, and there's nothing else that says disk 2, so it matches up to this down here. But we've got 100% free space. And probably the reason why we have 100% free space is this hasn't even been assigned a drive letter. So this is probably an external drive that has been plugged into the computer, but for some reason it doesn't have a drive letter associated with it. So it's kind of hard to use in most cases, use a drive without a drive letter. There are some cases where you can use it with a drive letter, but it's rare. So I think either of those two partitions could be used to move all kinds of data from drive C onto one of those other drives and partitions, and free up that space on the C drive. So I would say pick an internal drive if possible. And the reason why you want to do that is that if it's an external drive, it may get disconnected from the computer. So all of a sudden you have some data that you've moved to there, and then all of a sudden you don't have it available if you've unplugged the drive or turned the power off on it or something like that. If you have an internal drive, then it's going to be always there, always available for you. So if you wanted to use this disk 2 partition, which I suspect is an external drive, but at any rate, if you wanted to use that, you have to really assign a drive letter to it. So within disk management, if you just right-click anywhere here, you'll get a pop-up menu, and you can choose the option to change drive letters and paths, assign it a drive letter, and away to the races. So how can we move the data that's there? You can actually just manually copy all your files or move them from one drive to another, but there's probably a better way of going about doing this. And one of the ones is using the Windows libraries. So Windows libraries are just pointers to specific disk locations that are used for standard file types. So the libraries that are most commonly found on a Windows computer and are there by default are the desktop, documents, downloads, music, pictures, and videos. And so those are just, when you see them in File Explorer, they're just pointers to a location on disk somewhere on your computer. The default location is going to be the boot drive. And in Windows parlance, the boot drive is where Windows is actually loaded from, usually C:\Windows. So it's on the C drive. And so the actual physical location of desktop will be under C:\users\your username\desktop. And then documents at that same level. And all of those other libraries are physically located within that structure and so forth. And they can contain a huge number of files or volume of files, number and volume. As you can imagine, with things like documents, pictures, music, videos, that's the bulk of the files that you're actually interacting with on your computer. So they are going to be taking up a lot of space. So the nice thing is that Windows libraries can be moved to another drive. It's just a pointer to a physical location. So I can actually locate them on any drive. So the way to do that is if you go into in Windows File Explorer, and I go under This PC, you'll see all of your libraries there. So desktop, documents, downloads, music, so forth. If you right-click on that, you'll get a pop-up menu over here. You go down to this, and you choose Properties. Then when that opens up, there's a Location tab, and that will tell you where the current location is, and you can click on Move, and you'll get a prompted for a new location. And in this case, you can choose Drive D or Drive F or wherever, whatever other physical drive or partition you want to move this that has all kinds of space on it. And then once you choose that new location, it'll be returned to this Properties box, and then this Apply will be enabled. Right now, it's ghosted out because you haven't changed the location at all, so you can't apply any changes. Once you choose a new location, that will become enabled. You click on Apply. You'll get prompted to say, do you want to move the files to this new location for this particular library? And so say yes, and it'll take care of moving all of those files for you, which might take considerable amount of time depending on the amount of files that you're trying to move. But eventually, it'll come back, and it will have all of the files in the new location, freeing up that space on Drive C. And the nice thing is, going forward, when you save something to your documents folder, it won't be saving it to the C drive. It'll be saving it to that particular new location. So there's one other location that you can do outside of the normal libraries that you can move, which can actually contain a huge number of files as well, and that's your app data file, app data folder. Now, there are three app data folders, local, I forget what the second one is, and then local low, and then roaming. Roaming is the only one that can be actually moved. Okay, so if you go to /users/your-username/appdata-roaming, you'll get to the right place. However, it is a hidden folder. Okay, so if you don't have it showing hidden files, if you go into File Explorer, you can go to the View tab and check the box saying hidden items, and then you will see the app data folder. Or what you can do is press Windows key plus R, and then if you just type in %appdata% and press enter, it will actually bring you to the hidden folder. Now, notice on here that when I looked at my app data roaming, it's using 53 gigabytes on my desktop. So this can be a considerable savings in disk space on your C drive if you move that to another location. So if you use the method of going Windows plus R and typing in app data, it'll come up like this. It'll actually come up to the roaming folder, and you just click on app data in the bar, and it'll jump up one level. And then you'll see the local, local low, and roaming folders. Again, local and local low can't be moved. There are some ways to move it. I don't recommend anybody actually tries it. It's not for the faint of heart. And if you do it wrong, you can actually break Windows. So I suggest strongly that people just leave local and local low there. They're not that huge typically. So right-click on the roaming folder, and then you basically go back and you would choose like the going to the properties, that, and then going to choose a new location, applying it, and then moving forward. The computer will use that for app data. App data contains all kinds of things that is used by programs to keep track of data that they need to keep track of, including things like browser caches and all kinds of stuff like that. So that's something else you can move, which can save you an enormous amount of space. So the other thing that I thought of is that you can move programs. So under the C:\programs or C, program files, or C:\programfiles x86 is where typically programs end up getting installed. That's the default location when you go to install a program. So it's all on the C drive. So you could uninstall large programs and then reinstall them to a different location. Almost always when you install a program, it suggests, you know, a default location, and most people just click yes, go ahead. But if you do a custom installation, not default or standard, usually you will be given a choice where you can actually say where you want it installed to. So you know, rather than doing it C:\programfiles:libreoffice, you could do maybe D:\programs:libreoffice, wherever you want, getting it off of drive C to some other device that has a lot more space. Again, I would suggest use only an internal drive for when you're installing programs. Again, you don't want to go to use a program and it fails because the external drive got disconnected from your computer. One final thing that I think you can do, and that's the location for Microsoft Store apps. Store apps don't get stored underneath the C:\programfiles or C:\programfiles x86. They get stored in a different location. To relocate that, you go to Settings, System, Storage, and then at that level there, you'll find, you scroll down a bit, you'll have this change where new content is saved. So click on that, and you have all kinds of data types in here. Now you could come in and rather than moving libraries the way I mentioned before, you could do it here. The trouble with doing it here is that you're not given any flexibility. It's at the drive level and it will create a directory structure below that and you have no control over it. So I suggest using the other method for moving the libraries, but for this, new apps, and this is only Windows Store apps, you can click on there and you can choose a different drive that you can store those on. Note that it doesn't move existing installations of Windows Store apps. So if you really want all of your existing Windows Store apps to be moved to a different location, you have to uninstall them and reinstall them. In many cases, that it's no big deal to do that. But keep in mind that in some cases you might lose some settings for particular store apps and things like that. Again, choose only an internal drive for the location for those. And the final thing is make sure that if you do this, make sure that your backup processes probably are going to need to be changed to account for those new locations for files. So make sure wherever you moved all your files to is being backed up as part of your daily, weekly, or whatever backup regimen. And that's all I have to say on that.
I don't know whether you mentioned it up front, Chris, but one thing you really should do is make a full disk image backup before you start moving all that stuff around.
Not a bad idea. Yeah.
And I suspect that that 128 gig solid state drive, it really only has Windows on it plus those recovery partitions. I'll bet there's some whacking big Windows backup files in there or something that's taking space and you can clean those out. I've run a dual boot system on a 60 gig drive. And I think one of my machines right now is running dual boot on 128. And they work fine. So there's got to be space there that you can get rid of. So something like disk cleanup is really useful. Yeah. And that tree size free will really drill down and tell you where all the really big files are.
Yep. So really yeah, doing stuff. Periodic housekeeping on your computer is never a bad thing.
So Wayne found the URL for Udemy, and it was indeed udemy.com, so that's right. Available. And we're basically at the end of our time, so we're going to postpone Bob's iTunes session until next week. And we really don't have any time for questions right now unless anything in there. Elizabeth's saying she's sorry she missed last week's session. She was asking about cassette to digital. She downloaded the deck and checked out the recording. So if you missed anything or you want to revisit anything, the PowerPoint and the audio file and the chat window are all available always on the Ottawa PCUG website. So one of the things that Chris and I have talked about is keeping this Q&A thing going. And every week we never seem to have enough material. And then by Wednesday night, we're overloaded with stuff again. But earlier this week, we had very little in the pipe. And I couldn't think of anything that we needed to do in terms of computer basics or smartphone basics or helpful hints or whatever. So one of the questions that we have for everybody on the call is, what is it that you need to know about computers? Because if we know what you need to know, we can probably find somebody who will give us the answer, unless it's something like PHP and WordPress. Sorry, John. I don't know. I don't know, like Chris. I don't know who knows all that stuff, but we'll try and find out. Anyway, so if you have questions or topics that you want to share, as always, send us an email to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. And we'll see you hopefully next week, next Wednesday, August the 17th. And that will be our next Q&A. So I hope everybody enjoyed tonight. And we're basically bang on time. So thanks for attending, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks much, folks. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.